Hey, it's time for this week's edition of the Terry's Talking Podcast. I'm David Campbell, your host, and I am joined by Mr. Terry Pluto, the only guy in Cleveland who's not on the injured list, I think, this week.
Pretty much, right, yeah. Terry?
How are you doing?
I am well, and I had a good time covering the MAC tournament and college basketball with the mid-major flavor is like one of my favorite things. And I tell you, David, you were to some of those games too that the crowds were great. And
absolutely.
It was just neat to see. I remember when they moved it from Toledo to there, to Cleveland, and I understood getting in a bigger market, but I had no clue that they would be able to build the fan base that they have at Rocket Mortgage Fieldhouse. So I think they had 8,000 for the final with Kent and Akron. And it's just such a nice event for the town.
Yeah, do you want to get into that first? And we got a lot of stuff to get to today. I know we want to talk about the Cavs and
yeah, we got a lot of things. We'll double back to that, but I figured I'd mention that.
All right, sounds good. Well, we're going to get into the Cavs to start off here, and I know we're going to the Guardians open a week from Thursday in Oakland. It's coming up fast, and I know the Browns have been making a lot of moves. We can get into that. We also got a couple of really good foul ball stories that you asked for last week from fans asking about foul balls they caught, and you told a story last week about a foul ball that you caught, so we'll get into that. And, a lot more. So, all right, I guess we'll start with the Cavs today, Terry. 43-25.
Mm-hmm.
They're playing 6:32 basketball. There's 14 games left, man. The playoffs are coming fast. The Cavs are still third in the East. They're a game behind Milwaukee and 11 behind Boston, and they're banged up. Every week we come and talk on the podcast about the Cavs, and they're just banged up. They're banged up all the time. But what are you seeing in the Cavs right now? What's striking you about how they're playing?
I'm really glad to see that they just haven't fallen apart with Mitchell being out. And I will say, I remember when they talked about putting platelets or something in his knee. That was a bit alarming to me. I looked it up online. You couldn't tell much, but it just don't want to hear that. And when
it's
came back,
platelet-rich plasma stuff. Is that what you're talking about?
Yes.
Yeah, right.
Which is supposed to. I'm not sure.
Aid healing and yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
I'm not going to even. I play amateur doctor, but I'm just lost on that one. But whenever you hear kind of a different type of treatment given to an athlete. A red flag always goes up with me just because it's not out of the usual, we're going to rest them or we're going to do this. So to see that they've hung in there, and like they won last night, I thought Garland was horrible. I think he was 1 for 9 on three-pointers and that. And to see LeVert stepping up, and LeVert's point guard skills just keep growing and growing all year. I mean, he could really run the offense, and he's so big, long in terms of his arms, that he's been, I think, the most underrated player on the team by far.
And, Terry, all these injuries, Chris Fedor was writing about this on Cleveland.com the last couple of days, but all the injuries are putting him into a lot of starting positions, which is actually, I think, helping his case for sixth man of the year because he's playing a lot of starters' minutes, putting up a lot of starter stats. And that's going to help his cause. But why don't I run through the injuries real quick, Terry?
Sure.
We found out today that Donovan Mitchell, he's battling that knee bone bruise. But also over the weekend, he took an elbow or probably an elbow from Tristan Thompson. And today, and we're taping this late Tuesday afternoon, Donovan Mitchell had a procedure done at the Cleveland Clinic to kind of reset that nose or realign it, I think was the word they used. And he's going to be out at least a week. And we can come back to that. Max Strus battling a knee sprain. Evan Mobley's been dealing with his ankle. Dean Wade's been out. It's just been one thing after another. I wanted to ask you, Terry, do you think if there is a silver lining in what Donovan Mitchell is going through with 14 games left, it's probably not terrible that he's getting a week to recharge a little bit before the playoffs? I guess if you were to find a silver lining, that might be it, right? He could use a break a little bit, right?
Maybe, but he's missed a lot of games already. I think he's missed 14 or 15 already, whatever it is. So, no, how's that? I'm not buying it.
All right.
Not at all. No, I wouldn't want him playing 40 minutes a night going to the playoffs, but I'd want him on the floor because when the Cavs are at their best, the ball is in his hands. That's what we've learned this year. And he's running that offense, and he is the sun. Other players are the planets revolving around him, and it really clicks extremely well. Garland, to me, you put you put a lot of pressure on him handling the ball, the offense, he gets beat up and he wears down. So this is, I think, a key part here is JB is going to have to play Porter more. You know, he's been relying on LeVert to kind of, you know, carry things. But not only you don't have Mitchell, but Strus was somebody who I thought his ball handling was underrated. And I don't know when he's coming back. What do they call it? Does he have a knee bruise or what does he have?
Yeah, it's a knee strain, I think, is what they're
whatever
calling
that is, yeah. And so that's a and also, I sometimes worry a little bit about Jared Allen wearing down because he does have an injury history. That's one thing. He tends to get hurt some every year. And remember last year he was hurt towards the end of the season. And not having Mobley puts a lot of pressure on him. So this is going to be very tricky for JB because he's going to want to win as many games as he can to keep that higher seed. But then you don't want to just run this whole group into the ground. Getting Morris, wow, that was what a pickup. But it's NBA is strange how that happens, where a guy's a good player and suddenly he, a contender trades him somewhere else and then he's just sort of dumped out there. And you pick him up and you go, what's that about?
Yeah, so it's crazy, Terry. So yeah. Marcus Morris has been sitting on his couch or playing with his kids or hanging out with his family for like the last month plus.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess he and JB go back to when JB was in Houston and Marcus Morris was drafted. And they've kind of been keeping in touch over the last couple of months. This is all based on what Morris told Chris Fedor. And they just decided to bring him on a 10-day contract. So I think what we're going to see here, I mean, after last night, the guy's 34 years old, comes in and scores, what, 14 points mm-hmm. in 20 minutes, if I remember right?
Yeah.
4 rebounds. And this is the kind of guy who you, in a playoff series, you want to get some minutes out of a guy like this to help hold the fort or get you over the top when you're trying to close out a lead in the fourth quarter. Could you see them signing him to another 10 day and then just
they better
him?
How about yeah, that? I don't yeah. even want to discuss it. They better. And I'm basically just want to make sure he was healthy. He was averaging 7 points in 17 minutes a game for Philadelphia earlier in the season. Then he was traded to San Antonio. And that was one of those, we take the veteran contract to do whatever. And then you dump the guy. And he's available. I mean, a year, I think, the previous season, not this year, I think he averaged 11 for the Clippers. And you go back a couple of years, he averaged 15. I mean, he's a viable NBA player. And so I also think getting Tristan back helps. And it's funny how Tristan draws these offensive fouls because he drives the defenders nuts with his relentless going after offensive rebounds. They ended up tackling him and he knows all the tricks about kind of getting in the first elbow, and then the officials don't see that, and they see the second one. So I, adding him being Thompson, and adding Morris is huge to kind of keep this thing going in the right direction. They're going to need, though, to take some of that burden off of Garland in the backcourt and take some off of LeVert, and that's where I think Porter has to play more. And just watching them lately, once in a while, Merrill will like drive in the lane and actually shoot the ball. But sometimes he's in there, he's 8-10 feet from the basket, and they're not guarding him. Shoot it. You know, I don't care that analytics says that's not a great shot. I don't want to see him driving all the way in there, turning away from a very easy shot, and then throwing, you know, some ball 27 feet away from the basket to Jared Allen or something. And I've seen that. It's like, don't do that. You know, you're a basketball player. You're not just a stand-and-shoot guy or a run-and-shoot guy all about threes. Yeah, I believe something like 85% of Merrill's points have come on three-pointers. I mean, I listen to him and I say, no, you're more of a basketball player than that. And they need him to be more of that right now.
Yeah, that mid-range game, it's kind of become a four-letter word in basketball these days. It's weird to think about.
You watch Niang play. You know, he likes the threes, but he'll go rumbling in there and, you know, dum 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 dum. He gets about 6 feet from the basket and flips the ball in. He, you know, one guy bounces off him. He throws another one around. And, well, what a wonderful pickup he has been for this team, because they would be in huge trouble without him. You know, Kobe's done a nice job of adding veterans. If they just had Strus during this period, they would be in much better shape, because that guy, I think really is one of the heartbeat guys for the team. That said, I mean, we're talking about what they have the third best record in the East, a game behind Milwaukee, and all we do is talk about their medical report.
Yeah. So Terry, I wanted to get your thoughts on this. So I'm watching the tournament bracket for the NCAA's come out on Sunday, and I started thinking, like, you don't know what you're going to get in any of those NCAA tournament games, right? And I mm-hmm. kind of started thinking the Cavs are like, it's like they're going to be in the NCAA tournament. I have no idea what to expect from these guys. I don't know which Darius Garland we're going to see. I don't know what kind of Evan Mobley we're going to see. I mean, you know how it is going to these last 14 games. It's kind of like getting your pitching rotation set for a playoff series, right? You got to make sure everything's in order, guys are healthy. But do you have any concept of what the Cavs are going to look like? Was there a stretch of this season so far that you've seen where you're like, that's what it should look like? Or are you just like everybody else waiting to see what this is going to look like when they get into the playoffs in mid-April?
If they have Mitchell and Struess, and it's a big if, that's a good team, even without Mobley. I just think that goes back to their identity is around Mitchell, not just scoring, but handling the ball, setting the tempo. And Mitchell was, you know, averaging 5 rebounds a game. And then you turn around, you have Struess and you have Niang. It's a different looking roster. I think Jared Allen has learned he can score. He really can. Now, if you think about how players are, they come into the league and then they get told, well, this is especially somebody like Allen. While he was a first round pick, he was not a glamour selection or whatever. Say, if you want a long term career in this league, you rebound and you defend and you dunk. And that's all he was told. And he did it for quite a while. And then it's like, no, there's more to your game than that. And they're squeezing it out of him now. And he's growing. So that's what it could be, but really so much is predicated on the medical report, as you said, and I don't know what. And then on top of it, so they've had, what, a busted jaw with Garland and a broken nose with Mitchell this year? I mean, if you heard that, you'd think they were both on a flight with each other. So, I mean, but it's just obviously it happened on the floor, but it's like, man, oh, man.
This is the Golden State Warriors, right?
Yeah. No, it wasn't Draymond Green and forget who it was, Poole or somebody. So it's like you need guys wearing face masks or something. And so we'll see. I'm trying to think what else comes to mind with you with the Cavs, David?
Well, I think when they went on that run after the first of the year and we saw Mitchell, like you've been talking about this, Terry, Mitchell running the show like Michael Jordan used to do, everything going around him like you were just talking about. And I think everybody doing what they do best and being healthy. And then you drop in guys like Morris and Dean Wade and, Okoro's going to have some interesting matchups in the playoffs, depending on who they face. Like, you need guys to be at their best. Mm-hmm. I think the Cavs can win a couple series, and then who knows, you know? So,
like, the other night, Okoro struggled offensively against Indiana, but Halliburton had a miserable night. And the reason was Okoro. He was all over him. And that's always a way to measure his value. Kind of look at the top shooting guard, or basically the top scorer, as long as he's not a big man, and Okoro's on him, and you can judge his value that way. And he has improved his outside shooting. I still wish once in a while more he would drive to the rim, because he's so strong and athletic. I haven't seen the exact breakdown lately, but he was like in the top 5 players for a while of just simply scoring on like fast break layups. They have that thing, because you've seen him. The old thing, he's going, I don't know where this whole thing about he's downhill. They'll go downhill in football first. Now they're running downhill in basketball. Last time I checked, the floor was level. But just some guys are faster than others and more athletic, and you want to maximize that talent.
Yeah, and you don't want to be in the way when he's going to the rim on a fast break.
No.
So, Terry, I did have the list here of games missed by Cavs this year. Evan Mobley, 31.
Wow.
Darius Garland, 24. Donovan Mitchell, 19. And Caris LeVert, 12. Struess is at 8. Allen, 5. Okoro, 9. And Dean Wade, 11. Sam Merrill, 5.
That, like, I forgot LeVert was hurt for, what, 12?
Yeah, LeVert was 12 games, yep.
Elbow and even Okoro was out, what, 9?
9 games with that knee, yep.
See, I would have guessed, like, 5 for each. I really would have. So, but I know JV is a lousy coach. I'll get some more emails.
Hey, real quick before we move on from the Cavs, Terry, the Cavs are playing the Heat tomorrow. Mm-hmm. Then they have another game coming up with them soon, too. I wanted to get your early thoughts here. If you have to choose between number 5 Orlando, number 6 Philly, number 7 Pacers, or number 8 Heat for the first round, who do you think is an early matchup you'd like to see the Cavs
get? I want 5 and 7. I want Indiana and Orlando.
I agree.
They have less experience in the playoffs. Embiid is a wild card, whether he's going to play or not. That's who I want. I want some team that's even more playoff untested than the Cavs, and that would be those two. I also, watched that game the other night. Indiana is a strange team. I mean, Rick Carlisle's gotten playing better than they have in quite a while, but I mean, that looked like a bad Cavs clunker. The way they're playing at home on that thing, and are up by 15 in the second quarter against, I mean, think about it. Out there on the floor, Tristan Thompson, nobody wanted him. None. Now he's coming off a 25-game suspension or whatever. Marcus Morris, like you said, is coming out of his backyard, scoring 14. Garland's having a terrible game. Jarrett was good, but not super. Merrill had a nice game. And they won. They ambushed them on their court. So, see, Indiana will have some games like that because they just don't defend very well. And I think they're number 2 in pace, which means they play the second quickest pace. So I'd rather play them than somebody like Philadelphia. And I don't want to play Miami. I just don't. I don't care how bad they are, what they're doing. They're going to make it ugly. People are going to want to fight, all that. No, I don't want to do that.
I agree with your order, Terry. I would take the Pacers as the most favorable matchup. You talk sometimes about who keeps you up at night if you're a football defensive coordinator. Like, who keeps you up at night on the Pacers other than Halliburton? Like, I don't know the answer to that. Orlando, I would pick next because of just how physical they are. And I don't know if the Cavs want to play that kind of series, especially in the first round. So I would put them number 2. And then I would put Philly number 3 if Embiid is playing the Cavs. They just don't have an answer for him, really. I don't know. Maybe Thompson can help. I don't know. And then the Heat, I agree with them, number 4. You never know what you're going to get. An amazing coach.
And so. You just don't want to see it.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's exactly it.
All right. So the Cavs do have the Heat tomorrow on Wednesday. Then they are at Minnesota on Friday, at Miami on Sunday for a quick 2-game road trip. And then they're back against Charlotte. And then they've got a big West Coast swing coming up in April during the Women's Final Four, when the Women's Final Four comes to Rocket Mortgage Fieldhouse. So a lot of good basketball coming up in Cleveland. So, all right, you want to talk some baseball, Terry?
Sure.
Oh, man, where do we start? All right.
Here's where we're starting. Chase DeLauder is not making the team.
Yes.
I don't care if he doesn't make it out for the rest of the spring. He's not making the team. He has 242 professional at-bats. They want to give him some more. And they also want to go with Esteban Florio, and they want to go with De Los Santos, the kid, the Rule 5 kid. So those two are going to get the first crack at things. And you saw they sent Manzardo out. And the good news is that both of those guys were hitting in spring training. So you can take some solace in that. And the fact that they could bring him up in 4 weeks, 6 weeks, or whatever. So that's one of the things I want to do. I got that right from the top. I don't think anything's changed. And
Chase DeLauder could have hit 600 this spring, and he would not be with the big league team. Like, there was nothing he could do, right?
The debate for them is, do they put him in Double-A or Triple-A? Because I think he only played like 8 games in Double-A. I mean, last year was his first pro season. Now, granted, he's a college player, but still, it's just, I was trying to find some sort of equivalent. I mean, unless you talk about Dave Winfield going straight to the big leagues from college or somebody like that. They're just, when it comes to hitters, there just aren't much that you're going to see. Like, so, and, we have to accept what this year is, and it is a big rebuild year. That's right, well, what that, it is.
That brings me to a letter from listener Russell Gantos from Fort Worth, Texas, Terry. And he says, hey, guys, I've been a Tribe and Guardians fan since 1959, and I live and die with every game. As a follower of MLB for 60-plus years, while Lightning sometimes hits a team where everyone has a career year, most teams that win usually have a bunch of guys who have a history of consistent success. As you look at this year's Guardians team, we have one guy, Jose Ramirez, who fits that mold in eight other spots where there is hope and a prayer. Even if we add the Naylor brothers, Jimenez, and Stephen Kwan to our probably hopefully list, I see way too many spots that need production for us to challenge for an AL pennant. Please look at the spring results and give us old guys some hope for this year. Terry, can you give Russell any hope of positive things to
like
come?
Winning, blowing away the Central Division or something? No.
Yeah.
No, I can't. I will say, you know, you have a I always call Jose the secret superstar because only in Cleveland do we know it. I think you have an emerging star hitter in Josh Naylor. He's put together two really good years. You have an all-star caliber second baseman, although it's often driven with his glove and Jimenez. And then after that, I like Kwan as a leadoff hitter. And after that?
All right. It's early, but we're a week out, right? So what is your starting line? What are you putting out there in Oakland on the night of March 28th on the road?
Well, you got the Naylor's catcher.
All right, let's go through the outfield first. Let's go left to right.
No, I want to go through the outfield last because I'm still figuring that out.
All right. Go ahead then. Do it.
So I got the Naylor's, and I intentionally went that way. And then I've got Jimenez as a second. Shortstop. I guess Rocchio. He's hit a little better lately. That's what we can start getting. A guy has a couple singles lately. You go, he hit a little better lately.
He's in.
He's in.
Start, put him in.
Then Jose. The DH is probably De Los Santos. And that brings us to the outfield. Well, you do have Stephen Kwan in left. And I'm thinking they want Florio to play. And at this point, I want Florio to play, even though he hasn't done much of anything.
I think he's batting, 167 this spring?
Which is up from last week he was 3-for-30 when we were talking, so he's up.
All right.
So
you
were talking to Tom Hamilton about him. He said that early in camp, Florio was just sort of a basket case, swinging at everything and that. And it's one of those where you watch the guy and you realize if he were doing this all the time, he wouldn't hit 200 in AAA. So in other words, he was fighting a lot because he'd been up and down with the Yankees over the last few years that all said, oh, here's your big chance. You're in there. And, you know, people react differently. And then in right field, you know, I guess you platoon Laureano and Brennan. I mean, that's what you got.
And Miles Straw is the odd man out here, right?
Yeah, odd man out, or he could play some. And basically, you got one outfielder. You got one. You got Kwan. You can juggle the rest. All right. I never thought I'd do this, but I'm going to quote Eric Wedge on something that actually, besides some awful cliche that he would give. Is one day Eric and I were sitting in the, I never thought it'd be Eric Wedge story time, but one day we were just like, Eric Wedge. This will be the first and last of Eric Wedge story hour.
Story time with Eric Wedge.
Yeah. I forgot why I ended up in his office with him afterwards. And we were just talking. And at that point, Casey Blake was trying to like get going. He barely made the team. He had a bad spring or something. And I said, what do you think of Blake? He says, if Casey could just get through the first 7 or 8 weeks, I think he'll play in the big leagues for a long time. And I asked him why. He said, because he's been up and down with teams and that. And he goes, that wears on guys. He said, then you just have to decide, which we've decided here. We're just going to give him a shot and see how it goes. And he turned out to be right. And if you think about that, when guys are in the middle 20s, I think, like, for example, Florio's 26, you could say you shouldn't be so nervous or this or that. You get told you've been, in effect, fired or at least demoted enough times. You need some success. And the other thing, well, you just need to have confidence. Of course, what kind of confidence, you know, success breeds confidence, all that. But he had turned out to be right about Blake, because at that point, nobody knew. I think they had gotten him from the Dodgers or somewhere, wherever they got him from. And, you know, and he had a nice career.
And so that's what you're talking about with Florial, is just that he hasn't had success where he feels like he belongs. And it's going to be hard to do that in Cleveland and Oakland, like in April, you know? So it's going to be tough.
That's why you said if you could ride out the first 4 to 6 weeks and get through it, he might start to be able to play. Now, will Florial do that? No, but that is the theory behind you open with him, you play him. De Los Santos, the theory behind it, simply we don't want to get him back to Arizona. That would be what Cleveland would say. And he's starting to get a few hits down there.
And so young, too.
Yeah, he's 20.
Yeah.
And you went to the whole trouble of drafting him. You think he's got power. So I think if you get him through this year, then you don't have to offer him back. Next year, you could even send him to AAA if you want. So that's – I mean, we have to kind of look at the year as the – this is what they're dealing with. And then I wrote about this before the second wave of bullpen injuries showed up, which is the bullpen scares me to death. I mean, they already put too much emphasis on Quase last year. And now, all right, what is it? Stefan is out with Tommy John.
Yeah, I think I can run through the list real quick, Jerry. Stefan, Tommy John surgery, he's off for the season. Karen Check is going to open on the injured list.
Whatever's going on with him.
Sore right shoulder.
Oh, yeah. This guy, he shows up with a sore right shoulder.
Hentges is going to be out with, I believe it's the middle finger on his pitching hand.
He's having me to death, by the way.
Yeah, and of course, Daniel Espino, he's going to be out on right shoulder capsule.
All right, this is not personal. Okay, but I say this, but I don't really want to hear the names Espino and Valero in any depth.
Until
they're actually played about a month. I'm very serious.
All right. We'll strike them from the show.
Now, here's why. I mean, you know, there was an old, it's like Waiting for Godot by Samuel Beckett. You never thought we'd have a French existentialist playwright come into this, but
if you talk about Eric Wedge, story time.
Because you know there's two guys that are waiting for this guy Goudreau who never shows up, and you know waiting for Valero and waiting for
Espino,
and you're wondering what are you actually waiting for? What have they really shown you over any extended period of time, as in like a whole full season? You haven't seen much. So the scouts love them. So do the rating systems. But let's not worry about them. So therefore, you know, you're looking at Hunter Gaddis pitching the seventh or eighth inning. Tim Herron, Eli Morgan, who I don't like very much. Nick Sandlin, like just when you think he's getting it, he goes in the game and walks the bases loaded. But it seems like his ERA is always pretty good, but I think he gives up a lot of other people's runs. But that second part, I've never really looked at. But the bullpen, this is a nightmare for a rookie manager as a bad bullpen.
And the other thing, I think I can mention that Gavin Williams is going to be on the injured list to start the season two with a right elbow. So like you said, Terry, not only is the bullpen injured, but they're probably going to have to be coming in earlier because – the starting rotation is not what it should be either. That's going to tax them even more. So they're going to have a rough start.
I mean, Carlos Carrasco is going to be important, whether he's a fifth starter or he's going to be a key part of the bullpen. I was talking to somebody with the Guardians there, and they said he's throwing okay. You know, not great. But this is, the old line where you want to go back to the legendary Cleveland talk show host Pete Franklin or Terry Francona. In fact, Francona's line was more succinct than Franklin. Francona's line always was, when you think you have enough pitching, go get one or two more.
Well, some good news, Terry. Shane Bieber looks amazing.
Yes.
His fastball is 2 or 3 miles an hour faster. It's got good movement. Mm-hmm. And he has been named the opening night starter for the Guardians against Oakland.
And so far, I'm almost afraid to mention this because it's the old, you don't want to jinx him. But McKenzie is throwing well. So that's been, cause at this point already, McKenzie was hurt last spring. Cause I remember I was down there in the middle of spring training and he was supposed to like start the next day or something. They walk in. Well, Tristan's got a little bit of a problem. A little bit of a problem. Ended up pitching 12 innings all year or whatever it was. So,
all right. So the Guardians are getting close to wrapping up spring training. And like we said, they open at Oakland on the 28th. And the home opener, most of you probably know already, is going to be April 8th, the day of the eclipse in Cleveland. Full totality in Cleveland, and that pretty much guarantees it's going to be 52 and cloudy all day, right? Yeah. All right, let's take a break. When we come back, I want to ask Terry why he feels better about Jameis Winston this week than he did last week when we were on the podcast. So we'll get into that and some good foul ball stories when we return on Terry's Talking. Hey, we're back on Terry's Talking with David Campbell and Terry Pluto. Hey, Terry, we were talking a lot about Jameis Winston last week, and you've been writing the last few days. You kind of did some reporting and looking around, seeing what was going on with Jameis Winston, and you've been writing that you feel better about the signing than you did a week ago. Why don't you spend a few minutes talking about that?
Well, I mean, I probably were like a number of Browns fans. You heard Jameis Winston, and fair or not, I flash back to all the off-field problems he had. Going back at Florida State and then later with the Bucks. You know, he had been suspended for 3 games for conduct with, I think, a female Uber driver. There was some other stuff when he was in college and that. So I'm like, oh, great. But I did notice just kind of a cursory thing that the last time there was any sort of suspension or anything was 2018. You know, he signed with New Orleans in 20. And I had this reader from New Orleans send me the front page of the New Orleans Picayune, a picture of like him waving goodbye. You would have sworn Bernie Kosar was leaving town down there. And there are these stories on what a great community guy he was, active in churches and with young men's groups. And he was the guy that the team was sending out to talk to people. And his teammates loved him. And so that was great to see, because they need stability. As they always talk about the room, they need stability in that quarterback room because of Deshaun Watson. Just, you know, he's had a suspension, he's had injuries, he's in and out. I mean, that's what Flacco brought. Now, I think Flacco, I don't think Winston could repeat Flacco throwing for 300 yards a game. The Browns are counting on Winston to be the guy that opened 2021 as a starter for the Saints. He was 5-2 in 7 starts, 14 TDs, 3 interceptions. He cut out all those interceptions. I mean, the 1 year he led the NFL both in touchdown passes and interceptions.
Yeah, it was 30 for 30.
Yeah, it was 30. It was 33 and 30. And I think Biard's passing. And so that's not what you want for your backup. I mean, that isn't part of the reason the Browns backed off of Flacco, because the interceptions bothered them. So he did not show a lot, but then in the 7 games in, he blows his knee and he has the ACL. Then he opens in 2020 as a starter, plays a couple games. He has a foot and a back injury. He's out a while. Andy Dalton takes over and he's a starter. And then the following year they signed Derek Carr. So basically Winston played 10 games in, New Orleans. The stats are, it's such a small sample size, it's hard to know. But reason I feel better is not just that he hasn't been in any trouble. There are very clear indications that he's changed his life around and become a big asset. Now, anybody who's, I mean, all of us, every day is a test. You know, the old thing, we live it one day at a time. It's a great motto from AA or Celebrate Recovery, whichever one you like, about how we are to live. And guys that have had some problems in the past, it's even a little tougher. But, I mean, Winston now has got some pretty good road behind him of 6 years. So that makes me feel better about him. I don't think we're going to know really what kind of player he is until he plays quite a bit in the preseason. I think he only threw like 47 passes all of last year. He didn't start a game. So it's just it's difficult to know. Now, that said, what do you think Tyrell Huntley was about, David Campbell?
Well, my raw reaction is that the Browns just went through a season where they were leaning on a fifth-round rookie and a guy who didn't really belong in the NFL in P.J. Walker, in my opinion, and they want to make sure that that never, ever happens again.
Yes.
And so they have brought in Tyler Huntley because, again, like you're talking about with Winston, he's got good experience. He's proven he can win games in the NFL, and he's not going to be thrown into anything for the first time because he's seen it all. And he knows the AFC North. I mean, they want to make sure that last year never happens again. That's where I was at.
Absolutely. And I noticed more teams going in that direction. That's why Pittsburgh did what they did with Russell Wilson and trading for Fields. It's like the Browns are sitting there going, I don't know why Tyler Huntley doesn't have more than a veteran minimum contract offer with some incentives. We'll just juice up our incentives and go get him. And Pittsburgh is sitting there going, what for Fields? What do we have to lose? Bring him in here. Now, why didn't the Browns go get Fields? I was told they're not real high on him. So I think they want more of a, you know, they wanted more of a Winston type guy behind there. And that's what I heard. Now, we'll see if that's correct or not. And maybe that information was wrong. But I was doing about a week before Pittsburgh got him, I was kind of pushing my Brown sources or whatever, and in my sense was they just kind of thought he was sort of okay, and that was it. So there you go.
Yeah, and the other thing I want to mention, Terry, is with Deshaun Watson coming back from the shoulder,
yep,
they're going to be going through mini camp, mm-hmm. OTAs, training camp. There's a lot of footballs that need to be thrown to a lot of receivers and running backs, and
yep.
You want to ease that load on Deshaun Watson and let him come in. So now if you have Winston, Huntley, DTR, and then you sign some undrafted free agent from Emporia State and bring him in and let him throw 500 passes during training camp, you'll be able to keep some of that load off of Deshaun Watson. I know that's the number one thing, is not rushing him back to back.
And Winston,
but these guys have to catch balls and get their timing down, so you need to have somebody throwing them. So,
and also think about what I said about Winston, 2021 ACL knee injury, 2022 a back and a foot thing. So he's got a little bit of an injury history. You know, the whole league at quarterback just about have a little, has somewhat of an. I've now turned into, I used to say cornerbacks in the NFL were like pitchers, can never have enough. You know, now I'm almost like quarterbacks are. If I could have four, and I have three who have started a fair amount of NFL games, I think Huntley started 9 or 10, I forgot what it was, and played in some others. I can live with that and feel better than, as you mentioned. Hey, by the way, is Joshua Dobbs signed anywhere?
He did, yeah. Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, wait,
Mary Kay just had it today. I can't remember what team it was with, but it was the way she wrote it was that he's still processing being let go from the Browns. He was very upset that happened, and that was a little bit of why he didn't come back. Also, the money.
Yeah.
I can't remember where he signed.
You know, if I were him, I would not have come back. Would you?
Probably not.
No.
Especially not with this group. I mean,
no, I've been there twice. Not once. Been not just been there, done that, but been there, done that twice. Niners signing Josh Dobbs to 1-year deal.
There you go.
So well, good for him. But, you know, Josh Dobbs, Tyler Huntley, either way, I'm good. I like it. You know, they could put him in. So we're going to be this whole Watson arm thing is just hanging over them until, because he probably won't play much in the free season, if at all. And then we'll have to see the regular season. But at least we'll get a chance to look at these other quarterbacks, and I think more than ever they will be getting them ready to play.
Yeah, and Mary Kay reported today that Deshaun is actually starting to throw a little bit today, very day. So, before we move on to the next thing, Terry, I do want to mention, if we learn anything from the Tyler Huntley signing, it's that the Pro Bowl does not matter. Because Tyler Huntley is a Pro Bowler.
How the heck was he on the Pro Bowl? What did that
happen? They had nobody else, and he basically played four games in the 2022 season and made the Pro Bowl because everybody else was either hurt or in the Super Bowl. So There you go. So Pro Bowler has lost a lot of its luster. I think Tyler Huntley was part of that movement. So
yeah, he was there, and then nobody wanted him this offseason. So.
All right, hey, I want to get real quick to this letter from longtime listener John Sibison. We've been talking a little bit about motion and pre-snap motion and how the Browns were 31st in the league. And John says, hey, Dave, you made a great observation in the most recent podcast, or a recent podcast now, I guess, because I've held this for a couple weeks, about San Francisco and Kansas City being among the leaders in sending players in motion. Since a team is allowed to send one player in motion, I've often wondered why the Browns wouldn't have a player in motion on each and every offensive play. Apart from putting added pressure on the defense, a player in motion obviously has a momentum advantage in building up speed over the other offensive players that have to be set. So why not utilize this advantage for one player on each and every play? And John also says, I need to give a shout out to Cavs play-by-play announcer John Michael. Of course, we all loved Fred, but John does a stellar job in describing the game and keeping the audience informed in such a smooth and enforced manner. Cleveland fans have been so blessed with so many great play-by-play announcers in all three sports. Absolutely, John. So, Kevin Stefanski was asked about this a few weeks ago about the Browns being 31st in motion. And he said, I hesitate to look in too much last year in that regard. I think motion, speaking of conflict, I think it can make life really hard on the defense. I speak from experience. When that picture is changing pre-play, it can make it really a challenge. You can put your receivers in advantageous positions via motion. I think what Coach Mike McDaniel did in Miami was really, those were new things that are now, you're going to see that throughout the league. But I think there's certainly elements to it. I think what we talk about a lot is you want to shift in motion with a purpose. You don't want to do it just to do it, but there are opportunities to create advantageous looks, and you certainly want to do it. So I'm reading between the lines there, Terry, and with the changes the Browns are making, I think we're going to see a lot more of this motion, and I do think what the Dolphins did with McDaniel last year, I think a lot of teams are going to be stealing that and getting back to John's original point. I think there's plays where you can gain an advantage by formation, right, by overloading one side or creating a matchup, and then you can create a mismatch with motion. And I think the Browns are going to be doing more of it. I'm just reading between the lines of what Stefanski said, and I think they're scheming up ways to do that.
Well, if you were 31st, it doesn't take a lot to have do more. I don't mean to you.
No, that's true.
There. Secondly, though, when you are in motion a lot, you have to be disciplined, because here come the pre-snap penalties. Illegal formations, you know, illegal motion, whatever you want to call it, or both. And remember, that's a pre-snap penalty. I'm at war with those. Yeah, that was my Belichick, Eric Mangini influence on me. So that is something that I want to make sure, if they're doing it, as he said, you're doing it for a purpose, and also just that your team is disciplined enough to do that. Now, one of the advantages to having, I think, a quarterback who plays under center more, which is not Deshaun Watson, but it is, for example, the 49ers, is it makes it easier to run a lot of that motion. Now, I do believe too, is in a shotgun a lot, so they found a way in Miami to do that.
Yeah, and you know, we know Kevin Stefanski from having listened to him all these years, Terry. When he gives an answer like that, there's something to it most times. And so I think that's going to be something I think fans should track, is like watching in the preseason. They're probably going to be pretty vanilla. You might not see a ton of it, but then like in week one, whether it's in Brazil or elsewhere, like what does it look like and how is it going to evolve as the season goes along?
I have an assignment for you.
Uh-oh, let's hear it.
Speaking of motion, next week, find out the last previous 2 years, where did Buffalo rank in motion?
All right.
With Ken Dorsey.
Okay. That's a good one. I will check it out, and we'll have it for next week.
I was just thinking about that. And then I'm not good at this football stuff. It's like, you know, the NBA, I'll try to break it down and probably know just enough to get it all wrong, but feel comfortable enough to take the chance. Football, I don't. How does motion relate to teams in the shotgun?
All right. Let me see what I can find on that for next week.
Miami did some really creative stuff. So,
When you get other coaches talking about what you're doing, it's not just Kevin Stefanski, but a lot of people are looking at this and saying, wow, this is new stuff.
Here's something I want to bring up. because I haven't given it much thought, but I've had one or two readers mention it to me. Kevin Stefanski getting a B- in that player poll. Didn't that put him like in the bottom 25% or something?
I think so. I don't remember where he fit, but that, yeah.
I'll look it up.
That surprised you?
I don't have any thoughts. Do you have any thoughts on Kevin getting a B-? Obviously, these teams are grading on a high curve here.
I'd like to see more than 1 year of it. I mean, Chris Jones gave the Chiefs as an organization an F.
Yeah.
And then they gave him the big contract and he gave him an A. So, he changed his vote in like 2 weeks. So like, yeah. You don't know what's motivating players and guys who leave, like when was the vote taken? So,
but no, this is more of the coach's ranking as opposed to the whole sales, the whole.
Yeah. But no, I mean, the same thing applies though. Like somebody who left here, like if Josh Dobbs was asked to vote before the season, like what would he have put for Kevin Stefanski after they let him go? I don't know.
All right, here we go. Nine coaches got an A. Seven got an A-. So 16 out of 32 were A- or above. And all right, where do you think? Well, this is interesting. Where do you think Kevin Stefanski ranked out of the 32?
18? 20?
27.
Oh, really?
Who do you think was last? And we've mentioned his name on this podcast. Oh, I'm sorry. No, I withdraw that. It's Josh McDaniels.
That was who I was going to say, but we haven't talked about it.
No. I was thinking of McDaniel. I was going Mike McDaniel, who was fourth.
Yeah. So Josh McDaniels.
So that made no sense. And then I just realized because they just had the last names. So,
yeah,
I'm looking. It's like Andy Reid was one, O'Connell two, Dan Campbell three. That's interesting. Campbell, you know, yelling at everybody. Tomlin 11, Zach Taylor 12, Sean Payton 16. So basically, everybody 16 and above is an A-. And Mike Vrabel 22. The bottom five were Stefanski, Todd Bowles. I thought he did a pretty good job. Bill Belichick, no surprise. Arthur Smith fired, Rivera fired, McDaniels fired. So. Robert Saleh, 24. Okay. I have nothing else to say on that. John Harbaugh was like 21, by the way.
Wow, really?
All right, here's my theory. You know what I think about that? The coach's report card is his record.
Probably make a direct correlation there, but...
No, it isn't. I'm just saying, because you said there's so many subjective things that could go into it.
You're saying... Look at the record, and that's all
that
you need to know.
Yeah, the old, you are what your record is, and in the end, you are judged by your record.
Yep.
Maybe not just for 1 year, but over a couple of years. I mean, in the end, we're talking with Stefanski. He has been the best coach since they came back in 99, and I would say the best coach since Marty. So you have to go back to the late 80s. And then also, he's taken them to the playoffs twice. And he did both of them actually under tough circumstances. One was his rookie year with COVID, where he got Baker straightened out. And then last year with all the quarterbacks and everything else. So in a league where half of them are A- or above, to give this guy a B- just seems odd to me.
And I do remember, Terry, I think he was asked about this within the last couple of months at some press conference, and he didn't like that he got graded that low. And he said he really wanted to spend this offseason checking it out. I do remember something like that.
Thought that was a good answer as opposed to like, it's a stupid poll and why, even if you think it's a stupid poll and why do we care?
All right. Hey, let's move on here. Terry, you wrote a lovely Faith in You column over the weekend, and it was kind of flashing back to a time when you were teaching as a younger Terry Pluto in a Cleveland school, and you wrote about the girl in red and American Pie and how it was kind of these things that had stuck in your head about a person who'd moved in and out of your life so quickly. Why don't you talk about that column? I know you got a lot of response to this one.
Yeah, I was tutoring at John Raper Elementary, which was on 88th and Huff. It was the early 70s. And I was trying to teach kids math, primarily multiplication tables, because if you can't get that, you're not going to get division and you're not going to get fraction. And thing about at Huff back then was, it was a really rough neighborhood. It was not that far out of the Huff Rise, but it wasn't like extremely dangerous. It was nothing compared to what we have now. But there was my favorite student, and I wish I could remember her name, I just can't, was a girl in red. She always was dressed very nicely in these red dresses, like bright outfits, but usually red with her hair in braids and ribbons in her hair. And she tried so hard. And now she had moved, turned out she had moved from school to school. There was some family problems. And then one day I showed up, and now here's a tough thing. When you're writing about something from almost 50 years ago, your memory, how much is memory and how much is, you know, I was at John Maryper Elementary. I did tutor math. I did one of the stories I mentioned in there was I was tutoring another kid. I remember his name was Clarence, and they threw a brick that hit our window. It just shattered it, but it didn't break it. It was there. And Clarence went to the window, looked at it, go, oh, they used to go here. They bad. I go, you got that right, Clarence. I just got him away from the window. I remember that distinctly, you know, but conversations and things, it's always sort of unclear. It's kind of like you get the outline of the mountains and then you try to color in the lake, you try to color in exactly what it was. So how much of the like small details that story is like what I want it to be or whatever is real? I mean, you talk to police who interrogate people right after something happened. He was about 5'11". No, he was, I think he was, you know, he was wearing brown. No, he had a blue dress. What do you mean he had a blue dress? Well, no, not he had the blue dress. The girl next to her had the blue, you know. So
your mind fills in the details.
Right.
Yeah,
but the heart of the story was a young man, me, tutoring there. And to this day, remembering this from almost 50 years ago, when I would see a little girl, African-American girl, in a red dress, which I had just seen recently somewhere, I just think about her. And I remember, at least in my memory, one day she said something like, do you live in a nice house? And I said, at that point, actually we did. We were living in Northfield. And I said, yeah. And I started to ask her. And I thought, I'm not going to do that because I think there's something behind the question. And we just went back to the multiplication tables. And the kind of column ends with how the teacher told me they had kind of taken her out and we weren't going to see her anymore. And that was a trouble at home. And just, you know, kind of once in a while wondering what would happen. Now, I got a lot of emails, I mean, four or five in this regard, simply from people who had tutored, one even tutored at the same school, but at other schools, have very similar memories from years and years ago of wondering, whatever happened to that kid?
And it's a frozen moment in time, yeah. And you think like, what happened to that person? And they kind of drop into your life and then swoop out.
It just comes back, and just her joy of seeing me and trying to work through that stuff. And it's one of those things you just know. Had this girl been in a stable home, she could have knocked the ball out of the park. I mean, you could just tell. But that wasn't what she was facing.
Well, let's hope it turned out right. I know you got a few letters where people were saying, I hope she ended up in a nice house.
I thought that was a
lovely sentiment. So,
yeah.
All right, Terry, I do want to mention real quick, I want to give a quick mention of our Dine, Drink, Clee podcast. It's produced in our newsroom. And if you're interested in food, Cleveland's a great food town. Check it out. Mark Bona, Paris Wolf, Pete Jakarian go on there, and they join hosts Josh Duke and Alex Darris. They have all kinds of great discussions, not just about like high-end restaurants, but everything from fast food to bar food to everything in between. So check it out. It's called Dine, Drink, Clee, and you can find it wherever you find podcasts. And that, Terry, will bring us to our letter portion of the show.
Yes.
We still have some Why I'm a Cleveland Fan letters. Okay. So I want to read one of those from Rudy W. And then we have two foul ball stories. Last week, you and I were kind of getting the foul balls that we've caught. You told a story about the one you caught, and I mentioned mine, and you said, hey, we should hear from fans. And we actually got a few in. If you want to hit us with letters about your foul ball stories or anything else, just a quick reminder, you can email us at sports@cleveland.com, and we will not talk to you, but we will try and get your letter on the podcast. So this is from Rudy W. Terry, here we go. He says, I left for college in Montana at age 18 and never moved back to Ohio. My dad and I always had the Indians games on the radio when I was growing up in North Kingsville. bought our first TV in 1954 so we could see the World Series. I listened to Ohio State on the car radio because it would pick up the Columbus station to catch Howard Hopalong Cassidy and Woody Hayes doing their thing. Even when I lived in Colorado, I'd drive the family to catch the Browns games in Kansas or Texas. I once drove to El Paso when a closer hotel didn't air the game. I subscribed to the plane dealer to keep
Montana
up over the years.
Montana to El Paso.
I know.
Why don't you just drive to Cleveland?
Closer, yeah. He says, I went to sports bars that had satellite coverage. I finally bought a pricey satellite dish to catch the games. Why not follow the local team? It's about loyalty, memories, and that constant thread in life that doesn't change. We might not have the best team, but we are the best fans. Everywhere I've lived and now here in Phoenix, us Ohio guys will always remember the World Championships of 48, 64, 2002, 2014, and 2016. So thanks for that, Rudy. Some good stories there. He put some miles on the car, didn't he, chasing down some games. So, all right, here's a foul ball story. And this one comes to us from David Tuckey, and he lives in Columbus. And David says, hey, Terry and David, in my 55-plus years of going to MLB games, I probably recovered about 6 to 8 balls during an actual game, never caught any on the fly. This includes one home run ball and even once a ball that was overthrown during between inning outfield warmups.
That counts.
It does, yeah.
Yeah, I've gotten a few where I was sitting down the foul line back when the bullpens at the old stadium were there. And a guy's warming up. I mean, we kind of learned to pay attention because he'd bounce some ball in the dirt and it would bounce off the catcher's glove and pop in the stand. So there you go.
Yeah.
If you wanted to catch balls, if you got there early before the game, like when the guy's warming up, remember the big stadium, go stand wherever you want, especially down in the foul line. Go there, stand by, kind of sit in the stands behind the catcher. You maybe get a shot 1 out of 3 times, you get one.
Yeah. And there's probably hundreds of fans who have Trevor Bauer balls from when he used to warm up before the game.
Oh, right? Lord.
Those cross outfield balls.
Who got that ball in Kansas City? Oh, no, I forgot. It landed in the Missouri River or whatever went through there.
All right, let's continue here with David. Continues on. He says, 2 foul balls do stand out to me. My first in 1972 at the age of 10. We always recall that first one. Mine was hit by Indian second baseman Eddie Leon. Is that how
Eddie
you say
it? Eddie Leon,
yes. Okay. And pitched by Yankee Steve Klein. I got both of them to autograph the ball. Leon that season and Klein after he was traded to the Indians a year or two later, I told Eddie that he had hit the ball. He asked me where, and I pointed to seats to the first base side of home plate. I recall my dad saying that if I had pointed over the outfield wall that Mr. Leon might have traded me a bat and a tour of the dugout for that ball. My other noteworthy foul ball was 14 years later on August 1st, 1986. I was coming up from Columbus with my girlfriend to visit my parents in Parma and see the Indians play the Yankees. The Tribe was 53-47 on August 1st, 6 games behind Boston and only a game behind the Yankees. This was rare to have meaningful games in August.
Yeah.
We drove up on a Friday evening and were listening to the Twi-Night doubleheader on 3WE. A crowd of 64,934 showed up that Friday night. We decided to drive straight downtown and buy our tickets for Saturday's game. No pulling the phone out or clicking a mouse. Ticket office, person to person, and cash with paper tickets. After buying our tickets for Saturday, we walked inside the stadium to catch the 9th inning of Friday evening's second game. As the gates were wide open to accommodate those leaving, we found 2 empty seats on the first base side near the dugout. It couldn't have been more than a couple of pitches, and that foul ball was coming our way. It deflected off a few hands, and I snatched it from the ground. There were 64,934 people, and it found me in my only half inning there. What are the odds? And he says, love the podcast. Keep doing what you're doing. So
that must have been
that,
fireworks
David.
Night or something. They had to be giving something away back then.
It's so wild, Terry. Like, I used to drive to Cleveland to visit relatives when I was a kid. My dad would drive down the shoreway, and they were playing the Yankees one 4th of July weekend, and there were 70,000 people in the ballpark. Like, they would draw 60 or 70,000 for the Yankees every game, right?
During the
– And
the
then power, 10 the rest of the season.
10, 8. the big thing, they had different giveaways, you know, bat day, ball day. The plane dealer used to have like a couple of things per year called Grandstand Manager's Night. It was started by Hal Leibowitz. And he would put a question out there like, you know, should Chase DeLauder make the team this year? You know, that kind of – and then people would come in and they had a way of giving him like half price tickets or tickets for a dollar if you entered, or I don't know quite how they did it. But there was a straight A students night, the old Cleveland Press. So they found different things like that. They also did Mother's Day one time where one of the gifts given to mothers going through the gate, I'm not making it up, was deodorant. What a way to show mom you care.
Oh, boy.
You know, they would buy stuff from Big Lots or whatever and just got to give it away.
Oh, man.
So that was that. What else do we have?
Those are the days. All right. This is from Michael Karp, and he's from Marietta, Georgia. And Michael says, in 1982, I was visiting Cleveland and went to a ball game at the old stadium with my friend Chuck. We were seated in the upper deck behind home plate. Midway through the game, Chuck took a break to go look for All-Star game ballots. Needless to say, the stadium was mostly empty, so I took advantage by hooking my legs over the empty seat in the row in front. I think Sandy Whittle,
Whittle,
or Ed Whitson was pitching when Rick
Dempsey. I covered those guys. I was on the beat back then.
This is your team, Rick
that
Dempsey,
was my,
the Orioles.
Oh, gee, I guess my old team, the Orioles, because I covered the Orioles in 79. Then I came to the point you were in 80 through 84. The, quote, Sandy Whittle, Ed Whitson era, I believe that probably was like 81.
You probably knew all 50 guys on both rosters that day, Terry.
Well, I pretty close, yeah. And Earl Weaver would be asking me, why did you leave us for that? Are you out of your bleeping mind? Well, Earl, it's home. Yeah, okay, fine, kid.
Yeah. We should have Earl Weaver story hour instead of...
we could have Earl Weaver story hour. And I have learned to clean them up over the years, so...
All right, Michael says, I think Sandy Whittle or Ed Whitson was pitching when Rick Dempsey of the Orioles hit a foul ball heading my way. I immediately tried to stand up to make a catch, forgetting that my legs were not on the cement.
Oh, boy.
That didn't work, but luck was on my side that day, and the foul pop-up literally came down right to me, caught it on the fly, and Chuck wasn't there to witness it. Some fans in the nearby section even cheered. I still have the baseball, the only foul ball I have caught to this day.
Mm.
And that's from Michael Karp in Marietta. So thanks for that, Michael. So there we go. We got a couple of good foul ball stories there, Terry, because of your suggestion. So.
And probably they were true because when you roll in Sandy Whittle and Eddie Leon, the odds are those were true stories.
All right, Terry, it's time for your book of the week, and I know you want to talk about this book called Saving Grayson by Chris Fabry. Is it Fabry? Okay.
Fabry,
F-A-B-R-Y, if you're looking at
it. Fabry, for quite a while, actually wrote some sports books like Ghostwriting Night for Earl Hershiser and some others. He's primarily a Christian writer, but don't get all, you know, freaked out by that in the same way like some people write a lot about the Jewish experience in New York or whatever. This is I'm halfway through it. It's a powerful book about a guy dealing with Alzheimer's and his family. And he was a writer at one time and, you know, kind of time slipping away. And maybe because, you know, as I've gotten older and especially all the time I spent in nursing homes with my mom, Melva, you know, she's not in the Alzheimer's ward, but you see that. And you just realize that, boy, oh, boy, you know, what a thing it is. And it's sad, but it's powerful because the story, it's people. Fabry's written a lot of good books, F-A-B-R-Y. Look it up online and just kind of see. A lot of them he sets in West Virginia where he grew up. So that's my novel of the week.
All right. I have a book, Terry, surprisingly.
Please.
All right. There's this guy named Rick Rubin. Mm-hmm. He was a very well-known music producer. He actually was heavily involved with Johnny Cash toward the end of Johnny Cash's life and helping put out some Grammy award-winning work toward the end. But he's got a new book out. I don't know if it's new, but it's new to me. And I started reading. It's called The Creative Act, A Way of Being. It's all about creativity and letting the universe hit you in creative ways. And it's beautifully written. It reminds me a lot of you in terms of the writing style, Terry. It's very... plain and powerful and easy to grasp. So check it out. It's by Rick Rubin and it's called The Creative Act, A Way of Being. So I think that's it, right?
That'll do it.
All right.
Well, of all the foul ball stories we've ever told, these were the most recent. Thank you, Les Levine.
Yes, indeed. We miss Les. And hey, everybody, thanks for listening again. Check out Terry's newsletter. You can sign up for it. It takes a minute, cleveland.com/newsletters. We appreciate you listening. We will be back next week for another edition of Eric Wedge Story Hour. Jerry's talking. We'll see you next week.